If you have any enthusiasm for Michigan history, consider visiting MLive's website today. A story by Emily Lawler looks at the historical role of downtowns in Michigan. Economic terms, basically. The economic impact of downtowns, main streets in Michigan cities, small and large, through the decades. There is a photo of some kind of parade in Mason dating from 1915, which alone is worth visiting the website for. I can hear the strains of Onward Christian Soldiers just sitting here. The article is Downtowns Now and Then, Why They're Important to Michigan's Economic Development. Interesting piece there from Emily Lawler of MLive. Later on, we learn about refurbishments to Michigan State University's Summer Circle Theater. We'll learn about that with Scott Pohl. Can we honestly say Michigan is a comeback state? Bob Schneider, Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, nonpartisan data organization, policy organization, joins us to explore that topic coming up as well. At the top of our program, there's been more controversy this week involving Aramark. That's the beleaguered food service company contracted to serve Michigan prisons. Yesterday, at a meeting of the State Civil Service Commission, one member said he felt misled when told of a $98,000 fine against the company that had actually been dropped. On Monday, an Aramark employee was arrested on suspicion of smuggling drugs to inmates at the St. Louis Correctional Facility about 50 miles north of Lansing. Around 90 company workers have now been banned from state prisons for various misbehavior. The Philadelphia-based company, whose three-year, $145 million deal began last December, has also taken heat for a variety of other operational blunders. In East Lansing on Tuesday, Governor Snyder said his administration is working through the Aramark situation. It's become a hot issue in the election campaign for governor. Detroit Free Press reporter Paul Egan has been covering the Aramark story, and he joins us now in WKAR Studio S. Greetings and welcome.
Good morning, Mark.
Let's start with yesterday's meeting of the Michigan Civil Service Commission. Russ Marlin, an official of the State Department of Corrections, appeared before the commission yesterday. What transpired exactly?
Well, one of the things Marlin was asked was why, when he last testified before the commission, which is March 19th, he told them the commission is responsible for privatization of state government jobs. And so they were interested in these problems with the Aramark contract. And in explaining what steps the state had taken to improve the situation, he had mentioned the $98,000 fine. What the commission didn't know and what we didn't know until last week was that 6 days before he testified in March, the director of the Department of Corrections had said he intended to waive the fine. Aramark never did pay it. One particular commissioner said he felt misled. Robert Swanson wanted to know why Marlin testified that way when he did. And also, if he didn't know then, why didn't he come back and tell them once he did find out? Instead, he read it in the newspaper.
And you write that Mr. Marlin, he later told the Free Press that he had only learned of the cancellation of the fine about a month ago. How does that figure into this?
Well, it's interesting because it raises more questions. You have a department director has sent one of his officials to the Civil Service Commission, has given some incorrect testimony. The director doesn't correct him. According to Marlin, he didn't find out until about a month ago. There had been repeated stories in the Free Press and other media that reported this fine had been assessed. In August, the governor had come forward and announced a new fine against Aramark of $200,000 because things had not improved. And at that time, the administration also made no mention of the earlier fine being essentially canceled.
You referred to Robert Swanson, who's a Democratic member of the there are four members of the Civil Service Commission altogether. Was there any comment on this from the other three commissioners?
Not on that particular issue. There was some discussion about how common. There was some discussion about the drug smuggling issue on Monday, and One of the commissioners, Commissioner Barrett, who's a Republican appointee and formerly was a top official with the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, wanted to know how common drug smuggling incidents were among state employees rather than among contractors. And Marlin gave him some numbers related to that.
You reported on this drug smuggling incident back on Tuesday, and again, this is the incident at the St. Louis Correctional Facility, about 50 miles north of Lansing. How has Governor Snyder or others in his administration responded to that, if at all?
Well, Democrats, including the Senate Minority Leader Gretchen Whitmer, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer, have again, which they've been doing for months, called on the governor to cancel this contract. Governor Snyder has said, we're working through the problems. We don't want them to continue. They are serious, but we're addressing them. He's recently appointed a new independent oversight contract monitor, a former Corrections Department official from Florida and Indiana.
Ed Buss.
Correct.
Tell us about Ed Buss.
Well, he's got an interesting background because he's worked both for private healthcare companies that have moved into the correction system. That's a controversial area in itself, where states have privatized prisoner healthcare, and there's been cost savings, but also litigation involved with that. But his most recent job was in Florida, where after only 8 months on the job, he resigned basically at the request of the governor. There had been controversies over him allowing a sort of an, I believe it was MSNBC, but one of these kind of reality shows about prisons to come into one of the prisons in Florida. And there had also been a controversy about a contract that he awarded where there was a sign that a relative of a consultant that he hired on the job was going to benefit from this contract. So he does come with some controversy behind him. The governor's office says they have a lot of faith in him. And in fact, they tried to recruit him to be the director of the Department of Corrections back in 2011. Hmm. But Florida sort of won the bidding war for Mr. Buss at that time.
And what do you know about the authority he will have? What kind of position is he assuming here?
Well, he's a special advisor to the governor. He will report in part to the governor, but they've placed him in the Department of Technology Management and Budget, where he reports to that department director. But basically, he's going to oversee how this contract is monitored, who monitors it, and setting some standards for performance to try to get this contract back online. One of the concerns Aramark had had was that they believed that former state kitchen workers had been hired to monitor this contract, and they felt that because they'd been displaced by out of their jobs, that they had a bias against Aramark. Now, the AFSCME union actually says that none of those contract monitors were former state kitchen workers.
Paul Egan is our guest of the Detroit Free Press. He has been reporting for some time on the Aramark situation here in Michigan. When is Ed Buss scheduled to arrive? Is that known?
He's here already. He actually started right after Labor Day.
And how do you feel the Snyder administration is responding to the Aramark situation first and foremost with Mr. Buss's arrival, or are Do you anticipate a more comprehensive response to this thing?
Well,
is his appointment their primary response?
At this point, it seems to be. I mean, there is the $200,000 fine and the appointment of Mr. Buss. I think they're hoping that things are going to calm down, which they had for several weeks, actually, until this incident on Monday.
This has become an issue in the gubernatorial election with the Democrats, including candidate Mark Schauer, blasting the administration, calling on the Snyder administration to fire Aramark. How is the governor's campaign approaching the issue?
Well, that's an interesting one, Mark, because I get a lot of feedback from these stories. And, you know, the general public sentiment, because one of the main problems with the contract, at least one of the major complaints, has been shortages of food, quality of food, although there's also been other problems with fraternization between bringing in contraband. But in general, based on a lot of the feedback I get, I don't think anybody's going to make a great campaign issue out of the quality or quantity of food that Michigan prisoners are receiving. And you know, rightly or wrongly, many people just feel their criminals, you know, feed them bread and water is a sentiment I've heard often. But I think where this becomes a potential campaign issue is if it becomes a management issue. You know, why was the $98,000 fine canceled? Why wasn't the public told? Certainly things didn't improve after that, or you would not have had to impose another $200,000 fine. So, you know, there's also questions about the way the contract was awarded, and some of those issues perhaps resonate a little bit more, but it seems like it's always a difficult issue, I think, to make a major campaign issue out of something involving state prisoners, rightly or wrongly.
You alluded earlier to the possible, the allegations of the union's role in bringing some of these episodes to light, in terms of perhaps possibly monitoring the situation inside the prisons. The contract with Aramark did eliminate 370 unionized state jobs. Is the behavior of the Michigan Corrections Organization above board on this, or are there questions that have yet to be answered about that?
Well, they certainly have a vested interest in not wanting Aramark in the prison, because one piece of privatization could lead to more. Although it should be noted that the Michigan Corrections Organization represents corrections officers. They, you know, it's a separate union from the one that employed the kitchen workers. But Aramark certainly, even many of the wardens didn't really want this contract. They were concerned about security. So when Aramark came in, there's no doubt that many people were watching for mistakes and eager to report them. What we haven't heard is any evidence that any of the problems that we've heard about were fabricated. They seem to be real problems, but there's no doubt that many guards, corrections officers, and others have been carefully watching Aramark and reporting any problems that they witness.
Suspicions have also arisen, arguably from partisan Democrats in this case, that Aramark may have been a Nerd Fund contributor. Is this something you've looked at or know anything about?
The Nerd Fund was a 501c4 nonprofit corporation that the governor set up and later disbanded. One of the characteristics of a fund like this is that it can accept, not anonymous in that somebody knows who they are, but they can accept corporate donations that they don't have to disclose. The governor disbanded this fund several months ago because there was a lot of controversy about these funds. The governor's office has been asked if any Aramark officials or the company gave money to the Nerd Fund. They've said no, there were no such donations. But the question has been raised, and I think in part it does illustrate part of the problem with a fund like this, which the governor did eventually choose to disband, is that when you have anonymous corporate donors and you have problems with state contracts, people are going to wonder whether there is any connection, and there's nothing on the public record to show whether there was any connection or not.
I want to ask you one question unrelated to Aramark. Your paper's series on Michigan charter schools created a great deal of impact back in June. We have discussed it with guests a number of times. What kind of impact does a series like that have on the larger staff at a major metro daily paper like the Free Press?
Well, it's something, because it's such an important issue in Michigan education that I think some of the fallout from that series is affecting all of us. And there's certainly been a lot of the action has shifted to Lansing now. There's a news conference this morning about some more legislation that's proposed to address some of the issues that was raised in that series.
Paul Egan is a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. We thank him for joining us today. Thank you, Paul. Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Today, the MSU Department of Theater will dedicate the new home of Summer Circle Theater. Current state Scott Pohl is here with more on creating this new outdoor performance space on the MSU campus. This is a big improvement for Summer Circle patrons, isn't it, Scott?
It sure is, Mark. You know, you've been to outdoor theater performances. Sure. The conditions can vary, you'll agree. If you've ever attended a Summer Circle Theater performance at MSU, well, the experience wasn't always pleasant. Being near the Red Cedar River next to the MSU auditorium, Summer Circle was often plagued by water, mosquitoes, traffic noise, you name it. Well, the new space will be much more comfortable and will host events beyond these student productions, too. I met with the chairman of the MSU Department of Theater, Kirk Domer, and Friends of Theater president, Jackie Babcock, at the new Summer Circle Theater performance space between the auditorium and the Kresge Arts Center.
Well, the trick of Summer Circle is all about the fact that we are producing performance art that is free to the public. And we've spent half our time building the stage in which to produce the performance art for the public. So having a permanent space, it was just a no-brainer. And when our donors came forward saying, we want a permanent home, it's been around for 54 years, I think we're doing okay, this was the time to move forward.
Jackie, I assume you've been a longtime patron of the theater department and Summer Circle Theater. Would you agree that something like this was needed?
I agree. As an audience member, I can tell you that there are many days when I would sit down there with my feet sort of standing in water, and I think this is just a great opportunity. Plus, this is really more accessible for people, closer to parking. It's a lovely setting. I think it'll just be really special for patrons.
So, Kirk, you're saying that the idea came from supporters of the department rather than the other way around.
Yeah, absolutely. Sam Austin from the Cyclotron and his wife Mary Austin were the ones. They were very supportive, been longtime supporters of Summer Circle, and really wanted to say it's all about the arts that brings the community together. So scientists alike, humanists, everybody, they find vehicles through the art to actually be a part of a community. And so that's where he wanted his support to go.
Jackie, what can you tell me about the fundraising effort for this project? What was the budget for it, and what did it take to raise the money?
Well, the Friends of Theater were asked to come up with $100,000 towards the total figure, and that was a little over a year ago, and we were told that we had 5 years to raise the money, and we all looked at each other and said, yes, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it quickly. And I'm happy to say that just a little over a year, we've very close to our $100,000. The entire project still needs a little more money, but the Friends of Theater really have gone out there and did it. We had several fundraising events. We have a big gala every spring, and all of the funds went toward that. Our big focus was the outdoor stage, and we had a fundraiser at Craig Mitchell Smith Studio in Meridian Mall, and we had a fundraiser at Bergdorf Winery. So we sent out mailings. We all contacted our friends. I think we still have friends. We made sure that they all knew about the stage.
Well, Kirk, it's a rather simple-looking design, but I'll bet the full budget was more than $100,000. Can you shed some more light on that for me?
Yeah, the budget was about $1.15 million at the end of the day, and a lot of it was about creating the infrastructure for Summer Circle. So again, running the wires for the audio, the electrical, all underneath, preparing for digital means outside, and creating a weatherproof space. So this beautiful rubberized concrete that we have around us, it all drains beautifully. So Jackie's feet will no longer be in the mud. It will be on a nice bouncy rubber surface.
The stage itself is poured concrete with some simple brickwork.
Yes, and with that, we're actually going to build a semi-permanent stage over top. So it will go on for Summer Circle and come off so that we can use standard theatrical building practices to support them. Wind is always our enemy with scenery, so we want to make sure that it's stable for the creative process.
from day to day, does the scenery have to be moved inside between performances, or will this be able to protect scenery?
The scenery stays out, and we build it to endure the weather. The props, the costumes, all of that gets tucked away. And in this instance, though, the lighting actually gets to stay, because a lot of the structure that's built into the space secures all of the wires from the weather so that we're able to plug and play every night.
Describe this tiered seating area for me.
Well, everything's based on the circle. Finally, Summer Circle will have a circle as a stage. And the designer, Deb Kinney, she was a landscape architect on the project, she used this sort of the curvature of the circle to build into the seating. So two of our tiered layers are accessible to all patrons. The middle one is not, but that gives a variety for people to do that. But we still kept with the open area right in front of the stage. Picnickers, they want to come, they want to sit close. Everybody has their own protocols for how they want to view Summer Circle.
I'm with Kirk Domer from the Department of Theater at Michigan State University and Jackie Babcock, who is president of the Friends of Theater, and we're talking about the new home of Summer Circle Theater outside the MSU Auditorium. In years past, when we've talked on WKAR about Summer Circle Theater, we would often add the line, bring something to sit on. Is this going to be amenable to that for people who like to bring lawn chairs or other things to sit on?
Oh, absolutely. The tiered structure is sort of like an amphitheater. So if you liked the bleacher seating, the cold aluminum, well, now we have cold concrete for you. And you can sit along the front edge of that, but they're all tiered deep enough so that you can bring your own lawn chairs. So you still have the picnic blanket area. You won't be on grass, but you'll be on a very soft surface.
Was it a bit melancholy this year having Summer Circle out on the grass and next to the river, knowing it was going to be the last season over there?
50-50. With the amount of rain we had, it was a celebration of the last time Summer Circle will be on the banks. But again, this Summer Circle was here in the 70s, in this exact location that we're at now. So, you know, we can go wherever we want to go. The difference was our scene shop forever was in the auditorium building, so keeping it close was ideal. Now we're over by Breslin Center, so we're touring Summer Circle. So it really doesn't matter where the location is. This just gives a lot more visibility to the street and to the audience members to actually see the work that we're doing.
What kind of planning is already underway for next season, next summer?
Nothing. Right now, our current process is to put our season up first, and then we balance it with our summer. We promote for our students to get jobs outside of here, wherever they want to go. Summer Circle is a great way for students to stay around for the summer, get professional credits, and continue their education so they can graduate in 4 years. We have a dual purpose in that respect. Generally, somewhere around November, December, we'll start floating shows. And what's the mission, what's the theme of Summer Circle? But we won't know until maybe February what we're going to be producing.
Now, on Thursday, there will be a dedication held. What can you tell me about the events of Thursday?
Thursday, we're going to showcase a scene from the play written by Rob Rosnowski called The Summer Circle. And what's cute about this, we had hoped that we would be built and ready to go last summer, so Rob wrote a play. And it's a children's piece that has an adorable moment where the kids gather around and start doing theater. And then they decide, well, why don't we build a permanent home? And why don't we offer it free to all of the neighbors to come? It's a very adorable event that really captures the spirit of Summer Circle.
What's the time on Thursday? And will it be right here
yes.
on the outdoor site?
Yes. Weather pending, we will be here on the site. It begins at 4:30. There's a few speakers. Luana Simon will be here, President Luana Simon. We're going to have Sam Austin, who was our primary donor on the space, will be speaking. And then the little skit by the students from the Summer Circle.
Will it be the same cast that performed it this summer?
Exactly. Yeah, it will be. We were lucky enough that everyone cast in the show were returning students.
Excellent. You must be looking forward to next summer, Jackie, keeping your feet dry and enjoying Summer Circle Theater at this new location.
I am. I think that this theater has really caught the imagination of the public. I was telling Kirk that I work on campus, and so I walk by it at least once a week. And last week, there were two individuals standing on the stage just sort of looking around, and I thought, you can feel like you're on stage. You really get a sense of how great this is. So yes, I think it's a great thing for the community.
Kirk, one last thing I want to talk with you about is that this will be home not just to Summer Circle Theater, but it is in the plans that there will be other events held on this site. What can you tell me about other things that might go on at this location?
Yeah, we're still working on the details for, you know, everyone seeing the site and saying, wow, there's incredible possibilities there. So we're working on how people will be able to reserve the space. But I imagine wedding receptions. I imagine graduations. I've already been contacted by the fashion people in the art department, and they're like, we could do a fashion show out there. I imagine there's going to be classes out here as well. The art department generally has some drawing marathons that have been typically in this space. Now it's much prettier to do so. Also, our stage combat people are very excited about the levels and what they will be able to do in this space. So I have a feeling there'll be lots of arts-related programming that happens here.
Well, as people walk by this location in the months and weeks to come, I would encourage a glance over here because you never know what you might see. You'll see maybe the bare space like the three of us are standing on today, but you might see a wedding underway or combat rehearsal underway. There could be some fun things going on here when you least expect it.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to see what potential there is.
Well, Kirk Domer, thank you so much. Kirk Domer is the chair of the theater department here at Michigan State University, and we've also been talking with Jackie Babcock, president of Friends of Theater at MSU. Thank you both for being on Current State with us today.
Thank you. It was great. Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, thank you, and come to Summer Circle Theater 2015.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
WKAR in Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Are we truly a comeback state? And just how much can a governor influence the state economy? The Citizens Research Council, an independent, nonpartisan research organization that analyzes public policy questions, recently analyzed data to try to answer these questions. Bob Schneider is Director of State Affairs for the CRC, and he joins us as part of Current State's monthly check-in with the Citizens Research Council to help us understand important public policy issues in Michigan. Welcome back, Bob.
Thanks so much.
You crunched some numbers that looked at whether Michigan is indeed a comeback state. You hear that phrase every day these days if you're paying attention. In terms of employment, what did you find? Are we seeing more jobs?
Well, absolutely. There's some very good news. Recently, as we've kind of bottomed out of the Great Recession in 2009, we have a unemployment right now that peaked at 14.2% at the worst part of the recession. In July, it's down to 7.7%. So our unemployment's down. And in particular, if you look at the employment numbers, there's some very good news as well. Since 2009, again, when we sort of bottomed out, we've added 234,000 new jobs here in Michigan. That's a 6% increase. And even more significantly, we're growing back our manufacturing employment base as well. So employment in the manufacturing sector went up 20%, added 92,000 jobs. And in the auto sector, that subset of manufacturing, we grew employment by 32%, so 40,000 new jobs there. And that's significant because those are high-wage sectors in the economy. Mm-hmm. The manufacturing, if you look at average weekly wages in manufacturing, about 35% higher than the typical job in the economy. In the auto sector, 62% higher than the average job in the economy. So we're growing employment again, and we're growing employment in sectors of the economy that pay high, healthy wages.
I want to say yesterday I heard also that the unemployment rate actually dropped another fraction of a percent.
Correct.
I want to say 7.3. I might be off a little bit on that. But
that was the July number, the 7.7 that I was.
Oh, okay, very good. There is a lot of discussion about moving away from our traditional manufacturing base, and you referred to manufacturing jobs as a really important subset here. What do these numbers mean, the manufacturing numbers, job numbers mean, for those who are pushing to make Michigan's economy more diverse?
Well, they're still good. What you want in your economy, diversity is good in general from a risk standpoint for the economy. But you want a diversified but a high-wage employment base. And that is probably going to include a healthy manufacturing base. In fact, it almost is going to have to. Now, it's good to diversify that manufacturing base, but the key would be to do it within high wage sectors of the economy. And we have been doing that to a degree, but there's risk to that too, because the manufacturing sector is going to drive those high wages to the extent that you start to move to the service sector, and that's what happened. We did look at that. In 1990, Michigan's manufacturing base was about 21% of all employment came out of manufacturing. If you look at the 2013 numbers, it's just under 14%. So much smaller manufacturing base. That's probably bad in general in the economy. You want a healthy manufacturing sector. The auto industry is less significant. It was maybe 40% of employment 20 years ago. Now it's closer to 30% of all of that manufacturing employment. That's not so bad. But again, you want to, if you're going to diversify, you want to maintain high wage employment, and that's what's important to the state.
Bob, you also looked at the unemployment rate and found that it's not a good reflection of the Michigan economy. Why not?
It still can be a good reflection, and of course, everyone's going to look to the unemployment rate. It's less perfect, I guess. Now it's less good than it used to be. There's some suggestions in the data that we have more what economists would call discouraged workers in the economy today.
You hear about this so much more than in the past. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. The unemployment rate measures unemployed over as a percentage of our labor force, but it's only counting those who are looking for work. The survey process, are you looking for work? If you're not looking for work, you're not included in that unemployment base. And what we looked at is, let's look for the U.S. and Michigan. Let's look at that whole working age population. We use census data for 20 to 64-year-olds. Let's look at the whole population over time, and then look at employment, all employment, as a percentage of that, what we defined as the working age population. In the 90s, employment levels were about 80 to 85% of that prime working age population. Today, if post-Great Recession, nationally, it's more like 77%. This is as of 2012. For Michigan, it's 72%. Mm. So we have a lot fewer of the working-age population employed. Now, of course, unemployment goes up, and you would expect that to happen. But as the unemployment rates recovered, you're not getting the same kind of recovery in that figure. And that suggests that some folks have just dropped out. Maybe they're staying at home. Maybe they they're trying to update their skill set and going to training, college courses. But some of them are probably struggling a bit and working odd jobs. Maybe we have a bigger underground economy than we used to have.
Bob Schneider's our guest today on Current State. He's Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council, and we're talking about whether or not Michigan can be considered a comeback state. You saw slow wage growth as well. Tell us about that. What does that tell you?
We are getting – the good news is we're getting wage growth again. It's slower than normal. We looked at economists look at personal income. So we look for states, we looked at personal income in Michigan per capita. And on an inflation-adjusted basis, since the end of the Great Recession from 2009 forward, we are getting growth again. We're about 1.5% annual growth, roughly. That is a little slower than trends when the economy was real healthy. But it's still growth. So that is good news. The issue is Michigan's still fairly low when you compare us to other states. So the Bureau of Economic Analysis put out a recent report on this. Michigan had relatively high growth in inflation-adjusted personal income, 14th among states. But on a level, we're still 39th nationally. We're still in the lower, 20-25% of states in terms of where we're at in terms of our income levels. So it's growing. It's not growing as quickly as we would like, but, 20 years ago, Michigan would have been a very high wage state. We're not anymore, and that's still a problem.
A lot of this figures into the race for governor, whether or not we are indeed a comeback state. How much can a governor actually do to affect the state economy?
The governor can do some things. A state governor can have some impact, but really I would say the impact of a governor is more on the long-run prognosis for the state's economy. So what do businesses want? A skilled workforce. Governor can help set K-12 education policy, university funding, community college funding. How do we retain and attract skilled workers that have a college degree, have a credential that shows that they have some skills? Infrastructure is important to business. Roads. How do we make sure I have utility access? That kind of stuff. But what a governor can't do, unlike at the federal level, we don't do expansionary fiscal policy in Michigan. If we cut taxes, that helps businesses, cuts their costs, helps them perhaps add to profits, add to employment. But something else needs to be cut in our budget. We have a balanced budget amendment in Michigan. Cut taxes, something else has to go. Does that mean less money for the universities, for instance? Mm-hmm. Does it mean we pay Medicaid doctors a little less in their reimbursement rates? Something else is going, and that's taking away from the economy. So unlike at the federal level where we can do a big stimulus, that's not a quick fix is not really at the disposal of most state governors who live with balanced budget requirements in their constitution.
Well, hopefully we've offered our listeners a little bit more context and they are better qualified to answer the question whether or not Michigan is indeed a comeback state or not. Bob Schneider is Director of State Affairs for the Citizens Research Council, an independent nonpartisan research organization that analyzes public policy questions, and he joins us as part of Current State's regularly monthly check-in with the CRC to help us understand important public policy issues here in Michigan. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much.
It's WKAR's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Strange weather in Michigan, one of my favorite things, continues to affect various kinds of agriculture. Current State's Melissa Benmark has been checking into the effects of a hard winter and a cool summer on the wine industry in the state. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. I, too, am a weather geek and learned something very interesting in this interview, the placement of certain trees within and certain vines within microclimates of property, but we'll get to that. I spoke with Mark Longstroth this week. He's a small fruit educator for MSU Extension in Southwest Michigan, and you can't really talk about this kind of oddly cool and short summer's effect on wine grapes without starting a few months back in winter.
Last winter was a doozy, and we got real cold. We had snow on the ground for a long time, and it was about the coldest winter in 20 years. And we saw significant losses in the wine grapes. Not too many of the plants were killed outright, but many of them were severely damaged in that they lost fruit buds, a lot of fruit buds, or perhaps part of the vine was killed. We also saw damage in peaches. A lot of the peach crop in Southwest Michigan was lost to winter cold, and in some cases, even the trees were killed, so they have to replant those trees. We also saw damage in apples. Amazingly enough, we don't expect apples to see winter injury, and also in blueberries.
So a little bit of everything, basically.
A little bit of everything. It had been 20 years since we had a freeze like that, and wine grapes, European wine grapes, are generally considered among the more cold, tender plants we grow. I tell people that are interested in growing vinifera grapes that they want to look for a good peach site, because generally peaches start to lose their flower buds at about minus 10, minus 15 degrees, and that's the same range that the European wine grapes also suffer. And in the last 10 years, we've just about tripled our planting of European wine grapes and haven't had a real cold winter in a while. And so there were an awful lot of European wine grapes growing in not so good positions down here. We saw an awful lot of damage. But then we had other areas that didn't get as cold, and they had a crop of peaches, and they had a crop of wine grapes in northern Berrien County or other areas where it just didn't get as cold as it did in other spots. And so oftentimes people ask me what the crop is, and I say spotty, and they say, what does that mean? And I say, well, some people don't have a crop, and other people do, and they're happy.
And then this summer didn't turn out to be all that hot, or it didn't seem all that hot. Then how did that affect the various grape strains? Because it's already getting cool, and it didn't seem like it ever got that hot.
Well, we had a late spring, and it was real rainy. It helped them recover, but it was real bad for grapes. We've got several really significant grape diseases, and if it's rainy, then you have to spray. And so many of my grape growers tell me they've never had to spray as much as they did this year, because you were simply spraying to keep up with the fact that it had rained 3 inches, and so you had to protect against downy mildew. And when it got dry, you had to protect against powdery mildew. And so it wasn't the best growing season. It's been relatively cool. We're a week or two behind, and so many growers that have crop are waiting for the sugar levels to get up high enough to have high-quality grapes for their wine.
Obviously, Europe has a long history of winemaking, and they must have had some difficult years for wine growing. I know there's talk of the year without a summer in the 1800s and like things like that. They must have figured out how to compensate for bad years in some ways, and I'm wondering if there is any kind of collection of historical winemaking information that's useful in any way to New World winemakers.
Well, there's a lot of it. But again, they used to grow wine grapes in England, but they don't anymore. It's too cool there. I had one grower who was growing European wine grapes in central Michigan, and it's too cold, I think. And he was laying them down and burying them under the soil every year and then bringing them up. And that's very labor intensive. Oftentimes, we have several tricks we play here in southwest Michigan. One of them is to leave a couple of shoots very low to the ground. We might have a wire about 12 to 18 inches above the ground, and so that cordon or that arm will be below the snow and not be affected as much. And so there are some tricks you can play, but generally you don't want to have to spend a lot of time and money growing a grape that's not well adapted for your site. And so you generally try to grow a grape that does well year in and year out where you're growing your grapes. And an awful lot of wineries and grape growers in the last 10 years have tried an awful lot of new vinifera varieties. And you kind of hope for a test winner. And this certainly was a test winner. It certainly showed you where the very best sites were for the conditions that we had. But even some of the very hardy European wine grapes suffered significant damage in some sites. And those growers will have to essentially rebuild the vine. It didn't get killed. These are all grafted plants, so you just don't bring up a new shoot from the ground. They'll put up plenty of shoots from the ground. You bring up a shoot from lower down in the trunk. And in 94, when we had a winter like this, we tried to train those initial shoots that first year, but we've learned that it's better to let the vine grow like crazy because it's got a lot of stored up energy growing from the trunk and from the trellis arms where the fruit would normally be. And we let it do all that growth. And then this winter and next spring, the growers will choose the new arms and new trunk that they want and rebuild the vine. So some people had a crop off, severely damaged vines, and other people are hoping for a crop, a small crop next year, and a good crop in 3 years.
It takes 3 years to rebuild, then?
Well, in the worst-case scenario would be taking 3 years, where you would have to rebuild the trunk and then rebuild the arms. And even then, you would get some grapes in the second year, but then you should get a half a crop or more in the third year and a full crop by the fourth year. It takes time. It would recover much quicker than a newly planted vineyard because you have this well-established root system in the soil. And so you play a slightly different game trying to control the vigor, a wine grape that's well-established and trying to regrow after a cold winter, as opposed to one that you just planted in the ground and you're trying to baby up to the trellis wire of its first year.
We've been talking to you mostly about wine grapes, but I noticed that you're an expert on blueberries, and people may not know that Michigan is the top blueberry-producing state, I believe, most of the time. How did they do with all this strange weather over last winter and this summer?
Well, the winter was strange in several ways. Down in southwest Michigan, southern Michigan, we got our coldest temperatures the first week in January. And even though it got cold several other times, it never got quite as cold. Up north, they got their cold temperatures that hurt their wine grapes in March. And the area just to the west of Grand Rapids got their cold weather again in March, but it didn't get quite as cold. It wasn't until most of Lake Michigan had frozen over. So we have 22,000 acres of blueberries here in Michigan. And so the plantings that generally were very close to Lake Michigan didn't suffer very much injury, but the plantings that are more than 5 or 7 miles away from Lake Michigan suffered from those temperatures that did indeed drop to minus 15, minus 20. And we saw more of that in the southern growing region than we did in that northern growing region next or west of Grand Rapids. And so they looked really rough after they bloomed. We had a very heavy bloom, but when the flower petals fell off, there were very few leaves on an awful lot of the bushes that had been hurt by the winter, and they didn't grow an awful lot of leaves. And I thought that, goodness, we'll have a very short crop. But the rain that hurt the wine grapes really helped the blueberries. They like to be moist all the time, so the soil was really moist, and they weren't put under any stress. And we got a pretty good crop out of it. We certainly won't have the world record crop that we had last year when we brought in 114 million pounds for the state of Michigan. But I think we probably did 80 million pounds, which is just under our average and a pretty good crop. I think the people but then again, you had people that suffered severe injury on their farm, and then a few miles away closer to the lake, there were people that saw very little injury.
So it almost sounds as if this last winter kind of helped a lot of the growers discover what kind of I don't know that microclimate is the right word, but what variations on their particular patch of land were most conducive to growing various fruits.
Yeah, certainly. It certainly showed people, and it was probably what I would say is a worst-case scenario. I tell people if they're planting peaches, you know, that they want to plant in a peach site where they can expect to get peaches 4 or 5 years out of five. And if you're in an inland site where it's going to go to minus 10 very often, then there are going to be years when you're not going to have any peaches. And this year actually killed peaches. So people who might have been hanging on, you're certainly correct. We would have liked it to be just a little bit warmer. I don't expect to see another winter like this in my career, so hopefully no one else will. It has certainly been a while, and certainly people who had fruit crops planted in marginal sites certainly know that now.
Well, Mark Longstroth, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your expertise on the subject.
All right. Thank you very much, Melissa.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
.5 WKAR, it's Current State. You can also catch us, including past episodes on WKAR.org. A number of firefighting crews have been camped out along a main road at Michigan State University for the last couple of days. They've been taking part in an annual training exercise to learn how to rescue victims trapped in confined spaces. Turns out MSU has an ideal spot for this type of instruction, and Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now to explain what's been going on this week. Kevin, what's so special about this particular site?
Mark, undoubtedly, you have driven along Farm Lane near the intersection of Trowbridge Road. It's a very congested area. There's thousands of people there each day that drive through there. There's a railroad bridge there, and the road beneath is in a fairly low-lying area right there in that spot. And then right next to that bridge is a huge circular concrete pad with some steel hatches on it. That is a pump house that's designed to remove the rainwater that might flood the road beneath the bridge. It's about 30 feet underground. And obviously, there are people who have to operate and maintain the machinery down there. It's dark, it's cramped, and it's not the kind of place where you want to find yourself stuck.
It doesn't happen often, but when it does, we need to be ready to perform at the highest level in order to achieve rescue for the personnel who are trapped.
The scenario that East Lansing Fire Captain Greg Baker describes has thankfully never happened on this site. But as the old saying goes, accidents can happen. And that's the notion that brings rescue personnel from Lansing, East Lansing, Delta, and Meridian townships to the MSU pump house on this day. Baker summons his team beside the open hatch for a briefing.
All right, come close to the edge, but don't fall in.
In this simulation, it's said that two maintenance workers have descended without their safety masks. In this watery subterranean space, Baker says they succumbed to a dose of hydrogen sulfide, better known as sewer gas.
Our victims were down in there working on a piece of piping. They walked down there, they had a rotten egg smell, but then it went away. So we all know that hydrogen sulfide can quickly overwhelm your sense of smell. So what happened is that the sense of smell went away. They were eventually overcome by high levels of hydrogen sulfide and collapsed.
Baker tells the group they'll rappel into the space in pairs and hoist the victims out.
Any questions? Let's do it.
The teams hook up a generator and a fan to ventilate the pit with clean air to disperse the sewer gas. There's nothing more central to this rescue than oxygen. Baker says in a normal firefighting rescue, crews enter with their tanks strapped to their backs. But in a confined space, there isn't always room to maneuver. So instead, the tanks stay on the surface and the air is fed down to the rescuers.
Slack up on both air hoses, please.
The firefighters are strapped into a harness and lowered vertically by a pulley. It takes 3 to 4 men on the ropes to do this safely. They must take care to pull straight down and never outside the metal tripod frame that holds the pulley in place. This simple machine employs a principle of physics that even the ancient Egyptian pyramid builders understood.
For a 200-pound person, it only requires 50 pounds of pull in order to move them up. But you have to move 4 feet of rope for every 1 foot that they come up. They have to move a lot of rope in order to bring people up on that line.
Below, the men secure a 180-pound mannequin to a wooden brace. On the surface, an alarm sounds. One of the two tanks has reached 1/4 capacity. It's time to turn the full tank on and swap out the other. Minutes pass. Finally, success. The mannequin is safely retrieved, followed a while later by the first rescuer, Lansing firefighter Craig Wade.
Well, when you first go down, it's scary because you're hanging there, and it's probably a good 20 to 30 feet off the ground, and you realize you're being suspended by a rope. So, and when we first got in there, we actually had to make a swing to get to the actual where we need to be, so that was a little tricky too.
Two by two, the teams have run through this drill for hours on end to make sure everyone gets the training. Captain Greg Baker says with limited resources, interagency cooperation is the only way mid-Michigan firefighters can master this vital skill.
I just can't imagine a department in our area that has the resources, not only personnel, but with equipment that could accomplish this training. So we have to train together, work together, and then we'll have a seamless transition for when that time comes we have to actually rescue somebody.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll talk to a book artist about her work on Dock Undock. That's a project about immigration. And we resume our live music Fridays with one of our favorite Lansing-based singers, Twyla Birdsong. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.